You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer-powered,
listener-supported,
community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Don Guerra. This is WFHB Local News for Tuesday, March 9th, 2021.
So many who work tirelessly in public education supporting our children.
Later in the program, we turn to WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti for an interview with State Senator Shelley Yoder. She voiced her support to teachers who say that newly proposed bills would grossly underfund public schools. Stay tuned to hear that interview.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we have headlines from KiteLine, our public affairs program which covers prison issues around the Midwest and beyond. But first, your local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Tuesday, March 9th. I'm Jake Jacobson. Hoosiers ages 50 and older are currently eligible to sign up and receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Hoosiers who are first responders or healthcare workers still qualify to sign up for the vaccine as well. If you qualify, you can sign up online by visiting ourshot.in.gov, over the phone by calling 211 for assistance, or by contacting one of Indiana's area agencies on aging. Last week, President Joe Biden announced a directive that all states prioritize school staff and child care workers for COVID-19 vaccination, regardless of whether or not they qualify in their state. Indiana is still one of a shrinking number of states who do not consider teachers as an eligible group to receive their vaccines. Now, Indiana teachers and child care workers can sign up and receive the COVID-19 vaccine through a federal pharmacy program. Teachers and child care workers of any age in the listening area can make their COVID-19 vaccination appointment through Kroger's website. Indiana University McKinney School of Law professor Janet McCabe faced her first round of Senate questioning last week in her nomination to become deputy director of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA. McCabe, the director of the Environmental Resilience Institute at Indiana University, was nominated by President Biden in mid-January. If confirmed, this will be McCabe's second stint serving in the EPA. McCabe served in the Office of Air and Radiation under the Obama administration. That's all for your local news brief. From WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson.
Monroe County will move its main vaccination site to Simon Scott Assembly Hall starting March 29th. As of now, the Monroe County Convention Center serves as the county's main vaccination site. The move to Assembly Hall will increase vaccine capacity up to 2,000 people each day, according to Kirk White, head of Indiana University's COVID-19 response. White said vaccines will continue at Assembly Hall for an indefinite period of time during last Friday's local COVID-19 press conference.
Our plan is to be live and vaccinating people at Assembly Hall, Simon Scott Assembly Hall, on March the 29th of March. And that's why, as Penny mentioned, the convention center sites are filled up now. I expect within the next few days, we're plugged into the Zotec state system that you would log into as you go to ourshot.gov. And I expect the Simon Scott Assembly Hall site will start populating. So keep checking there, because we've been told that we'll have the supply, and we're getting our people trained up to do that and all the facilities in place. And we'll be ready to make some of our own shots in Assembly Hall on the 29th of March, and ongoing then through an indefinite period, as we become hopefully a regional resource site for vaccinations.
Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudill said vaccines will continue at the convention center through the remainder of the month.
So we are beginning to transition to IU for vaccinations that will begin next month. The convention center is open for first doses through March, and we will complete those vaccinations for anybody who needs a second dose that is vaccinated initially at the convention center. They will get their second dose of vaccine at the convention center. But we are making that transition so that IU will be the new kind of county location. And we will then in April decommission the convention center site. So you'll see that if you look at the Monroe County Convention Center vaccination map, that pretty much all those appointments are filled unless somebody cancels something. In the next few weeks, you'll start to see vaccination appointments open up at IU site.
As of last Friday, over 20,000 people received at least the first dose of the coronavirus vaccine in Monroe County. Caudill noted over 13,000 county residents are fully vaccinated. During the Q&A portion of the press conference, she explained why the county decided to make Assembly Hall its primary vaccination site.
It's really about capacity. And, you know, when Indiana University said we are willing to provide not just a closed site, but to open up for the public, that provided for great capacity. And as vaccine initially is coming into us in a smaller amount, you know, the convention center is great. And we are very, very grateful to have the convention center space, and it is set up very well. But if you think about tripling or quadrupling the number of people that you're getting through, then that space would be much more difficult. And so it really is just about capacity. And again, giving us the opportunity to partner with the university to help staff that, so that then our public health nurses and a few volunteers can then do outreach and make sure that individuals aren't falling through and being missed because they can't get somewhere or something like that.
IU Health South Central Region President Brian Shockney said the Medical Arts Building will also remain a vaccination site.
Yes, we will continue to be a vaccine site, and also are looking to when we start expanding vaccine to not only provide it in other locations, but as clinics, physician and provider clinics are allowed to provide that in the future, we will have it there as well.
Caudill said vaccine appointments will start to open up in the next few weeks at the IU site. Appointments can be made by visiting ourshot.in.gov.
The Bloomington Plan Commission presented amendments to the Unified Development Ordinance during their March 8th meeting. Development Services Manager Jackie Scanlon spoke about the reason for changes during the March 8th meeting.
We adopted a new zoning text for the UDO. It became law in April of 2020. And what we've been doing is working with that code since this time and identifying issues that may need to continue to be addressed or new issues with administration of that code. When that code was adopted, a conversion map was adopted so that the old zoning map was amended to have the new zoning district names, but no lines were changed on the zoning map. And so what we are working with now is the conversion map, and what we are proposing is a new official zoning map.
Scanlon spoke about plans for the amendments regarding plex developments. She said conditional uses would be allowed in the R1 through R4 zoning districts.
So this particular petition proposes duplex as conditional use in the R1, R2, R3, and R4 zoning districts. So you can see that here, conditional with an asterisk, meaning that there are use-specific standards associated. And then the triplex and fourplex, these two here, as conditional in the R4 and nothing in the R1, 2, or R3. That's the current proposal. And then there are use specific standards for all three, and those of the uses, duplex, triplex, fourplex, and those have all been proposed to be amended as well.
Stanlin stated duplexes would be allowed in more places than triplexes and quadplexes. She mentioned plexes are an integral part of a growing community.
We do think that they're necessary. We do think that they are part of a larger larger plan to help increase housing in the community, help have more land available, the existing land, existing infrastructure available to more people. But we understand that people are very concerned about the character of existing areas. And so in this way, by making them all conditional and limiting where the more intense uses are, we hope to strike a balance there.
Scanlon spoke about the six conditional use requirements developments must meet, such as not destroying historical areas or areas of significant importance. She mentioned conditional use requirements also bar the production of large amounts of smoke, noise, or light.
So conditional uses can be heard by either the Board of Zoning Appeals or the hearing officer by code. As we did with the introduction of ADUs, the department would initially take all plex requests to the Board of Zoning Appeals as opposed to the hearing officer if this were to be approved. One, it just is more visible, and it has more decision makers involved. Obviously, a five-person Board of Zoning Appeals as opposed to a one-person hearing officer. It also is more public in that it is held in the evening, and it is typically on cats, and it's just something people are more familiar with than the hearing officer. The hearing officer sees very, you know, small kind of correction variances and things that non-controversial that can be done more quickly and with little impact on the neighbors.
Scanlon stated the conditional uses attempt to make sure any new buildings are compatible. Commission member Brad Whistler stated the commission would consider which districts would permit plex housing development on March 25th. The next planned commission meeting will be held on March 22nd.
The Monroe County Public Library reopened the Indiana Room at its main location on Kirkwood Avenue with a capacity of 10 people. According to a press release, library patrons should limit their use of the room to 1 hour if others are waiting. MCPL's Indiana Room features an archive of local and family history, including sources for local genealogy research. According to the Indiana Room's webpage, the library expects a high demand for local newspapers on microfilm. In addition, the library launched a new community history project called the Monroe County Field Notes. This is a virtual dig to uncover stories about 19th century landmarks and people from 1816 to 1876. Patrons can request certain materials in advance by emailing indianaroom@mcpl.info.
Ellettsville Town Manager Mike Farmer proposed the disposal of a surplus street department trailer. He spoke of a new trailer replacement during the March 8th Town Council meeting.
We have a new trailer that's a Department of Public Works trailer, and it's up to date with all the new safety features and lights and everything. So we just do not need this property anymore. We'd like to just take some bids and see that it leaves.
Farmer mentioned a $2,000 reserve on the trailer. He mentioned the older model was outdated for their current uses.
It's a bit lightweight for our newer backhoes. And like I said, it's so old that for safety's sake, we just don't use it anymore. Somebody might be able to take it and had time to rehab it and use it for their personal use. It'd be a good trailer, but for what we use it for, it's just served its purpose. I'm almost sure it's at least 2 to 3 decades old.
Foreman Kip Hetty stated the trailer was 30 years old. Deputy Clerk Amber Wright stated a bid period would be open for the trailer until March 19th. Council members unanimously approved the transfer.
Up next, we share excerpts from KiteLine, our public affairs program which covers prison issues around the Midwest and beyond. KiteLine airs each Friday at 5:30 p.m. on WFHB. You can also hear KiteLine wherever you find your podcasts.
Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in the prison system and beyond.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to share these words across the prison walls.
The chanting you just heard was from a massive illegal demonstration in Athens earlier this week. Solidarity protests have roiled Greece as Dimitris Kofitinas, an anti-imperialist political prisoner, enters his second full month on hunger strike. He was a combatant member of N17, a Greek urban guerrilla group named after November 17, 1973, when the fascist military junta massacred revolting university students. N17 formed as the junta collapsed and was known for attacks against military torturers, major industrialists, and American interests. Kofitinas has been serving a life sentence since 2002 when N17 laid down its arms and has been recently transferred away from Korydallis prison in Athens. Per his legal rights, he is demanding a return to Korydallis to be close to friends and family. The Greek state began force-feeding him on February 23rd in order to prevent either his victory or his death. If he dies, he'll become the first political prisoner to die on hunger strike in Europe since 1981, when the UK killed Bobby Sands and other IRA prisoners. The ruling right-wing New Democracy Party has viciously attacked solidarity demonstrations, but despite extreme police violence, thousands of people continue to protest in recognition that if Kofitinas dies, it will set a precedent that the Greek state can dispense with all prisoners' minimal legal rights. Additionally, banks, ATMs, and police cars have been set on fire in claimed solidarity actions, and offices belonging to the Greek state have been occupied in Athens and in Germany. March 6th is a global day of solidarity with Kofitinas.
Officials at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola have kept some prisoners in disciplinary segregation longer than the prison's disciplinary protocols call for, leading to a hunger strike starting last week among several people incarcerated at the prison, who say they have been locked in their cells for over 23 hours a day, being let out only to shower. On Monday afternoon, the Louisiana Department of Corrections confirmed that there were three people still on hunger strike at the prison, and also confirmed that the prisoners had been held in disciplinary segregation past the amount of time that was determined by the disciplinary sanctions matrix for the rules infraction that they had violated. Ken Pasterick, a spokesperson for the DOC, stated that there is not adequate bed space immediately available to move inmates out of the disciplinary segregation unit. "All they're saying is, we ain't got nowhere to put you," said Frederick Ross, one of the prisoners involved in the strike. "Because of that, I'm being punished." 8 people in the prison who said they stopped eating the morning of Wednesday, February 17th, said that they were being held after the time designated for their punishment. Some, such as Ross, were being held for months past when they were supposed to be let off the tier, others for weeks. "We're being held here over our time," said Donald Hensley, who is 54 years old, "illegally, with no yard calls, no exercise, no sunshine, no clothing, no nothing."
Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, we turn to WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti for an interview with State Senator Shelley Yoder. She voiced her support to teachers who say that newly proposed bills would grossly underfund public schools. Aaron Comforti has more.
I spoke with State Senator Shelley Yoder about her support for teachers who are protesting state bills that take funding away from public schools and give it to charter and private schools instead. The protest was called Blackout for Ed, and teachers wore all black to bring awareness to the issue. To stay COVID safe, Senator Yoder and I spoke outside on the steps of the Monroe County Courthouse, so you might hear a little bit of wind or traffic. Here's the interview.
Senator Yoder, why did you come out with your support for the Blackout for Ed teachers movement?
This General Assembly
for this legislative session has really come out swinging against public education. When 90% of our children in Indiana attend public schools, our funding does not reflect that. But it's more than just funding, which is important, but it's also supporting teachers, whether or not they can come together and collectively bargain and have a voice for themselves. This General Assembly in this legislative session has come out fighting against even teachers' unions. So many who work tirelessly in public education supporting our children feel like no one is listening. Thus, the blackout that we saw this week.
Yeah, you're talking about how this current legislature has come out swinging against teachers and teachers' unions. What comes to mind? What are you thinking of exactly?
Well, we passed Senate Bill 251, a piece of legislation I did not support. And it was a bipartisanship that came together to oppose this legislation. But we were not successful in defeating it. And what that does is it really undermines teachers and teachers' unions. And we don't, you know, we definitely see an attack on unions in Indiana when we are now a right to undermine workers' state. But this was really drawing attention to teachers and undermining their voice and their ability to have a voice when it comes to their rights and their working conditions and their salaries.
And when we're talking about teachers, we are also talking necessarily about children. Mm-hmm. How do the legislature's actions affect children in Indiana, especially during this pandemic?
We know that we want to set Indiana's children up for success. And we also know that 90% of our children attend public schools. And when we had the global pandemic hit our school systems across the state, and our teachers were scrambling and working around the clock 24/7 to be able to supply and give a kind of education to lift our students up and to stay connected with them. Our legislative session should have been all about that, making our teachers and our students whole again. But much of this conversation in this legislative session has been to attack and undermine public education and actually not do what our public education system needs. And so at a time when we should be stepping up to the plate and responding to the great need, we are furthering the undermining of public education.
In this legislative session, there have been bills proposed that would increase funding to charter schools. You have proposed a bill in the past week that would take away funding to charter schools that are found to discriminate. Now, Republicans mostly say that, I mean, there's broad Republican support on the state level and on a national level for charter schools, as we saw with the Trump administration's selection of Betsy DeVos and her policy promoting charter schools. Here in the state of Indiana, Republicans are saying that charter schools will provide Hoosiers with more school choice and will give innovation to our classrooms. Why did you decide to take this approach to charter schools with your bill?
When it comes to the voucher program, and in this legislative session, working to expand the voucher option in Indiana, what we know to be true is the voucher program, the charter schools, the private schools, there is no accountability. There is no transparency. Unlike public schools, where we have school boards that are elected by the people to make sure that their school corporations are run transparently and that people have a voice, we are giving money to schools that can actively discriminate based on sexual orientation, gender identity, race, religious beliefs. And that is not who we are. It's not what our Constitution says. And I have a real problem giving tax dollars to zero accountability around those parameters.
There is currently a Republican supermajority in the legislature, in the Indiana legislature. What can Democrats do to pressure Republicans? Mm-hmm. What can Democrats do to progress their agenda?
It can't just be the Democrats' fight. When 90% of our children are attending public schools, we need to make sure that families, that business owners, that people are fighting for Indiana's children, not just Democrats. We need to make sure the Indiana Constitution says that we will make sure that all children have access to a common education. But what expanding vouchers have done in Indiana, it has actually undermined that common education. And so our public money, our public tax dollars are funding programs and schools that are not holding that up. So what can we do? It is an answer of we. We all must be fighting for our children and our public education system to make sure that Indiana students, the 90% of them that attend public schools, continue to get the funding that they have coming to them.
The proposed bills that Senator Yoder was talking about would give the 10% of kids who go to charter schools and private schools in Indiana 40% of the state's education budget. That means that the 90% of Hoosier kids who do go to public schools would be left facing a 30% funding shortfall. If you'd like to see the video of the interview I did with Senator Yoder, go to our website, wfhb.org. For the local news and WFHB, I'm Aaron Comforti.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Jake Jacobson, Cade Young, and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Aaron Comforti.
Kiteline is produced by Maya Beach. Our theme music is produced by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Engineer and executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be part of our award-winning news You can be part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Planetary Radio, a program dedicated to space exploration. That's coming up next on WFHB.
Been listening to the WFHB local news on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a WFHB local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB local news archive at WFHB.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB local news. We are local, longer,